This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Wednesday, May 29th. The Stanton Street Shul. Today's topic for current Jewish questions is women's head covering. And as I announced it in Shul this past week, it has no bearing on anyone in the Shul. It's one of those announcements that I have to make periodically when Rabbi gets up and gives a topic on something specific, especially something that, you know, touches on, I don't want to say controversial, but it's something that, you know, really evokes a very strong reaction. You know, sometimes people think like, oh, you're singling out me, or you're, you know, and that's not the issue. If there were ever a case, I'd either, you know, handle it in, you know, shul directly or talk to people personally. The reason why I picked this particular topic was, for some strange reason, I got four or five questions in the past week or so pertaining to women's head covering. It's an issue that never really goes away. People have a lot of different opinions about it for a whole bunch of reasons. And I'm not sure if there's going to be a straight conclusion here, but at the very least, we can start with the basics. And I'll throw in some other opinions I couldn't find actual sources for to make it to the sheet. For those who are interested, one of the best in terms of comprehensiveness studies, there was an article by Michael J. Broyd from 2009. There was a special supplement in Tradition called Hair Covering in Jewish Law, Biblical and Objective, dot Moshe, or Rabbinic and Subjective, dot Yehudit. And if nothing else, regardless of whether or not you accept any of his conclusions or his logic, he does a fantastic job of compiling major opinions and summarizing them very intelligently. So if anyone's interested in a really good, you know, primer for a lot more sources than what we're going to do, all the sources that we have here, he does. Well, I shouldn't say that. I take things in a little bit of a slightly different directions. Some of the sources that we do here are going to come up, will have to be cited by board in a lot of other places. One of the reasons why we do classes this way, focusing on Gemaras, is that you can take these sources and, you know, take them pretty much anywhere. Certainly the first couple of sources that we do are going to come up in every single discussion on women's head covering, or at least they have to, because these are the primary sources. So it'll give you at least some sort of a foundation. If in case you do additional reading or go to other classes, you'll have some better idea of what people are talking about. But if you want to do research on your own and to see more of a, you know, historical development and, you know, more detailed with even some analysis, you can see Rabbi Broyd's article. The citation is at the end. If anyone doesn't have access to Tradition, one of the great things they have is you can actually buy articles for cheap. I forget if it's $2 or $5 an article, but like really, and this is a huge, huge article. How many pages is that? It starts on page 97, goes to page 179. So like, you know, 80 some odd pages of research, but, you know, he's an excellent writer and it's relatively readable and accessible. All right. So let's get things started here. About women's head covering, and we'll choose, you know, words carefully in a bit. Everything has to begin with the Mishnah in Ketubot 7:6. Start us off, Shlomis. We're going to go.
These are to be divorced without receiving their ksuba: a wife who transgresses the law of Moses, or one who transgresses Jewish practice.
All right, so stop here for a second. Elush yotzeot below ketubah. You know what the ketubah is?
Yeah.
All right, so it's the marriage document. It was pretty much the ancient prenuptial agreement. It's a certain amount of money that the woman is entitled to from the husband's estate. In the event of death or divorce, she can even get money from it early in the wedding, but it's money she's entitled to from the estate. There are certain types of transgressions that are not only grounds for divorce, but she forfeits the right to anything from the estate. There's a discussion at the very end of the Tractate of Gittin of what constitutes grounds for divorce, and there's a three-way dispute on this. But here it says explicitly, you know what? These types of, not that there is somewhat of a significant affront or violation of some marital trust or bond, that it's almost like this constitutes a violation of that, you know, a matrimonial contract, so to speak, between the husband and the wife. And it's divided up into two things, Dat Moshe and Dat Yehudit. Dat Moshe sometimes will translate here as the law of Moshe, Dat being law, and Yehudit, or what's considered Dat Yehudit, is the law of Jewish women, which, as we'll see, Rambam later translates as Jewish practice or Jewish custom. Right? So, continue.
And what is regarded as a wife's transgression against the law of Moses? One, feeding her husband with
untithed food. Yeah, sorry, this is the Sincena translation again. Meaning, you have to tithe food from whatchamacallit. You have to tithe food, take away a tenth maaser before you can eat it, according to Jewish law. Like, never heard of that?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so the wife is usually the one in the kitchen preparing the food.
Right.
So if she feeds him untithed food, meaning she does, being in charge of, like, you know, the grain and produce and stuff in the kitchen and the dough, doesn't actually take it off, that's grounds for divorce and she loses the ksuba.
Two, having intercourse with him during the period of her menstruation.
Mm-hmm.
Three, not setting apart her dough offering.
Mm-hmm.
And four, or making vows and not fulfilling them.
Okay. So, alright, so we've got four things here. Anyone notice anything in common between all four of these things?
Well, it's all halacha. It's all
close.
Following,
yeah.
If you break the halacha, then that's...
Well, I would say, well said, in terms of breaking halacha, to make it a little bit more precise, you're breaking explicit biblical law.
Right,
I mean, this
right,
is called,
okay,
Dat Moshe.
Yeah.
You're right.
Adoraita.
I'm just... Exactly. Adoraita.
Right.
That's why I included in the English translation part here the actual chapter and verse of the prohibitions you're breaking. So this is Dat Moshe. This is the law of Moshe referring to the Bible.
Right.
The stuff that you have in the Torah. Additionally, some of these things are, I mean, the Gemara will go into detail, you know, for some of these, but these affect the husband, right? If she's preparing the food, doesn't make the food, you know, ready enough, it would be almost like if the wife, I mean, it's not mentioned specifically in the Mishnah at least, but the wife is serving the food, something he's not allowed to eat. The wife is making the husband sin.
Right.
If the wife doesn't go to mikveh, and we discussed this in the, I think it was the rabbinic ethics class on confidentiality or something like that. We discussed it in shul. I'm forgetting, my memory's gone. There was actually a very controversial case where a wife told a rabbi in confidence that she wasn't going to mikveh, and the rabbi broke confidence to tell the husband. And then that got into a whole big legal issue. Strictly speaking, according to this Mishnah, that act alone is grounds for divorce and she loses the ksuba. I'm sure the divorce, if that's what happened, I'm sure the divorce was a lot messier than just, you know, following this particular Mishnah. But again, you're talking about a situation where, you know, the wife has a certain halakhic responsibility in the household. The wife is not keeping it, thus causing the husband to sin. Therefore, it is grounds for divorce and she can lose what, and not is, sorry, not only is it grounds for divorce, she does lose the ketubah. She loses whatever attachment she has. But in addition to just violating what you called halakha or biblical law, you can, the wife can also get divorced for violating Dat Yehudit. Explain what that is.
And what is deemed to be a wife's transgression against Jewish practice? One, going out with uncovered head. Two, spitting in the street. Three, or conversing with every man. Four, Abba Saul said, such transgressions include also that of a wife who curses her husband's parents in his presence. 5. Rabbi Tarfon said, also one who screams, and one who is regarded as a screamer. A woman whose voice can be heard by her neighbors when she speaks inside her house.
Okay. So here, nothing mentioned here is intrinsically prohibited. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Being overly talkative. Midaberet im kol adam. Which, incidentally, it's, you know, translated here as every man. Medaberim kol adam, you know, really would mean every person would be a better translation than every man. Right? Spinning in the street. People explain this to me where it, like, will expose, you know, part of your woman's arms. cursing husband's parents, like none of these are intrinsically biblically prohibited, certainly not on the same level. That's why they're called practice. But yet, these are grounds for the divorce, and she loses the ketubah. And the top one that we're going to focus on is Yotze'ah V'Roshah Paruah. She goes out, and her head is uncovered. Before we even take it a step further, anyone have any thoughts as to what these might have in common? Or can we extrapolate from the suggestions here? Not suggestion, I'm sorry. Can we extrapolate from the examples given? What makes these so egregious that we're going to treat it for the sake of a marital bond the same level as causing the husband to sin, such that it's grounds for the divorce and she loses the ksuba?
Well, in this case, it's all stemming from immodesty. I'm being modest.
Including cursing your husband's parents?
That's well, disrespectful, but...
Well, not directly related to the modesty, or at least not the way you're defining it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that seems to be an anomaly. Right?
But that's also... Basically, again, it's against the fifth commandment, respecting your parents.
Yeah, it's against respect.
Ah, it's husband's parents.
But it's still...
Okay, there's a mitzvah, right, of kibud av. You have to honor your parents. To my knowledge, there is no commandment to honor your in-laws. It's probably a really good idea. Again, you've got single rabbi here. You know, just what I've been told. It's a good idea to be on good terms with your in-laws. It's something to keep in mind. If I forget to give my own take on it by the end, please remind me. But it's something to keep in the back of your head. All right? At any rate, we're going to, you know, table that for a moment and focus at least on this going out with uncovered head. Now, just with this Mishnah alone, an important detail to note is that Yotze'ah V'Roshah Paruah is under going out with head uncovered, is categorized as dat yehudit, as a matter of Jewish practice, but not dat Moshe, but not something that's a matter of biblical law. Thus, it seems that it's, you know, to give the dichotomy that Rabbi Borg did in his title, it seems, based on this Mishnah alone, more rabbinic and subjective, as opposed to biblical and objective, just based on this Mishnah. Now we get to the Gemara. And I, you know, split this up intentionally to show that here's the Mishnah, here's what the Gemara does with it. And, you know, we'll see that the Gemara kind of takes a very different spin on it.
I'm sorry,
I should announce this is a Gemara to vote 72AB, if anyone's interested. Yeah.
And what is deemed to be a wife's transgression against Jewish practice? Going out with uncovered head.
Right. So this is, like many Gemaras, it begins with a citation of the Mishnah, which is why here in the Cicino, when Cicino does the translations, it's in all caps. And I take out the caps when we just have a Mishnah in isolation. I keep it when it has the Gemara so you know when it is citing a Mishnah. One of the earlier uses of formatting back when the only options you had really were caps and no caps. So anyway, so that we've already seen before. What's considered dat yehudit? Going out with head uncovered. But
is not the prohibition against going out with an uncovered head
pentateuchal? I should really, even though that's a Cicino translation, change that to biblical, which makes a lot more sense.
Biblical.
Right. Isn't it a biblical prohibition to go out with head uncovered? That is an assumption. Okay, continue.
Why then is it here described as one of mere Jewish practice?
So the question assumes going out with head uncovered is in fact a biblical law, such that it's asking why is it categorized not under Dat Moshe as biblical law, but Dat Yehudit? All right? But now it has to justify. Wait a second. What is it? Where do you get women going out with head uncovered? So continue.
For it is written, and he shall uncover the woman's head.
Anyone know where that's from? This is from the passage regarding Sota. We read this a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
Right? One of the things that the woman does as part of the Sota ritual where, you know, write the name of God, dissolve it in water, she drinks it, is she has her head uncovered. The fact that her head is uncovered means, by implication, come on.
Or that she transgressed.
Plain and simple, from the fact that the Torah tells you she uncovers her head,
right,
means her head was covered.
Right.
Oh. Right? Yes, okay. Simple. Yeah, when I talk like that, like, it's usually the obvious answer. Right? You're not going to ask a woman to uncover an uncovered head. That doesn't make any sense.
Right?
So the fact that the Torah tells the woman to uncover the head means, by logical reasoning, the head must have been covered in order for it to be uncovered.
Right.
Therefore, by implication, it seems that the covering of the head must be biblical law. Continue.
And this, it was taught at the school of Rabbi Ishmael, was a warning to the daughters of Israel that they should not go out with uncovered head. Biblically, it is quite satisfactory if her head is covered by her work basket. According to traditional Jewish practice, however, she is forbidden to go out uncovered, even with her basket on her head.
All right. So here we have a distinction. Not that a woman's, that it seems, just from this passage, that it is a biblical law for a woman to go out with her head covered. The question from here, it seems how. Biblically speaking, a woman could go out with a basket on her head. And that's still done today in some places. You might, you know, see if anyone reads National Geographic, you know, the more exotic places where women will actually carry baskets on their heads. Right? Easy way of carrying things. So technically speaking, that would count for biblical law. But it's not that Yehudit, whatever that means, right? We haven't really explained like the difference there, but we're saying right now for this, you know, basket's okay biblically, but for dat Yehudit, no good. Continue.
Rabbi Asi stated in the name of Rabbi
Yochanan,
with a basket on her head, a woman is not guilty of going about with an uncovered head. In considering the statement, Rabbi Zera pointed out this difficulty. Where is the woman assumed to be when her head is covered by her basket only? If it be suggested in the street, it may be objected that this is already forbidden by Jewish practice. But if she is in a courtyard, the objection may be made that if that were so, you will not leave our father Abraham a single daughter who could remain with her husband, since all married women go about in their courtyards with uncovered heads. Abayi, or might be said Rabbi Kahana,
I mean, there's a dispute over who said the following statement.
Yeah. Replied, the statement refers to one who walks from one courtyard into another by way of an alley, into which the two courts open out. An alley, since fewer people frequent it, would not have been included in the restriction spoken of in our Mishnah in respect of a public street. Yet it is not considered sufficiently private to allow the woman to go about there with uncovered head. Hence the necessity for the specific ruling of Rabbi Yochanan.
So we now have another qualifying factor here, meaning, you know, Yotze'ah v'Rosh HaParah, going out with the head uncovered, requires two things that require it to be defined. One, what does it mean to have the head uncovered? And two, what does it mean to go out? So according to the second part here, there seems to be a distinction between public and semi-public areas, where if it's in a semi-public area, we can be apparently a little bit more lenient when it comes to head covering. Okay? So this is the basic source for women's head covering. Okay? Based on the straight Mishnah, right? It seems just that it's dat Yehudit. According to the Gemara, the implication is there is some biblical commandment behind it, even though it is by no means explicit, which is where you still have a bit of a difficulty. Because normally, if you want to say that there's a biblical requirement to do something, you know, you have to point to, you know, God normally isn't shy about telling you what to do and what not to do. And that point gets debated, you know, somewhat. One opinion that people cite, this is, I just cited here Maimonides, Rambam, although it's the same opinion pretty much as the Rif and the Shulchan Aruch, writes as follows. He says, this is in Ishut, chapter 24, I'm combining 11 and 12 with an ellipsis in the middle. Ve'elu heina devarim, she'im asat achat mehen, Avaral dat Moshe. This is how Rambam says. These are the things which, if a woman does them, violates dat Moshe. Right? And the first one is Yotza'a b'shuk v'se'erosha galoi. She goes out to the market and the hair of her head is revealed. Now, that's a pretty big statement right there. Right? Because what is Rambam doing effectively? He's taking sort of the Gemara part where it talks about head uncovered, saying, well, that's biblical, and he's actually putting that under the Dat Moshe category, where he's saying going out where, you know, the head uncovered such that the hair is exposed, that's breaking biblical law. That seems to be what Rambam is saying by calling that Dat Moshe. Right? By distinction, Ezohu he dat yudi, what is Ezohi dat yudi, I'm sorry if I misspoke, what is meant by Jewish custom or the practice? These are the customs of modesty which are practiced by Jewish women. And these are the things which, if a woman does them, violates, quote, dat yehudit. Now he's going to give the example. So again, he's defining dat yehudit as custom. And what's an example? Here it is, Gav Yitzhak, ala shuk ala mavoy mefulash. She goes out to the market or to an open courtyard with her head uncovered. Ve'ena le redid kechol anashim. And she's not wearing a veil like all the other women. Afal pisha se'ara mechusa b'matpachat. Even though her head is covered with her hair is covered with a scarf, she's not going out completely covered like all the other women. Interesting. Hmm. According to Rambam, and he seems, if I'm understanding correctly, to be describing what you would call a burqa. Now, why? That's what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. Now, any thoughts on this so far? Okay, so here's my interpretation of dat yehudit and why this fits in. The reason why I think violating dat yehudit is so offensive that it's worth being divorced, getting divorced over losing the ketubah is by not keeping the culture that all the other women in the community are keeping, the woman is in pretty much in public, or in some cases in private with a cursing, embarrassing the husband. And those are things that she would not be allowed to do. Meaning, even if it would not violate Jewish law, grounds for divorce in terms of you're actively going out trying to humiliate the person. The operative words in the Rambam here is, I think, again, this is speculation on my part, redid kechol hanashim, right? Doing what all the other women do. It's almost like a when in Rome thing. And back in the day, you know, really was a big deal. Today, it's probably a lot more culturally relative, right? But a woman who intentionally goes out and breaks cultural norms seems to be grounds for divorce. Might even be able to argue for, you know, embarrassing the husband in public, right? Now, you can still say that's extreme by today's standards, but by the standards back then, it makes a little bit more logical sense about why you treat it together, because embarrassing your spouse in public, especially for tight-knit communities, usually does not lead to healthy marriages. Or I shouldn't say lead to healthy marriages. It's not a good sign, and it probably doesn't help, right? Now, this allows, again, for a certain degree of subjectivity, though. And here's where you have that dichotomy. If it's objective, if it's biblical law, it's objective, and something has to be done. If it's dat yehudit, if the focus that it's the cultural norms, well, then in theory, cultural norms can change, too. Right? Because if there was a time where married women covered their hair, fine. But now, most married women, not saying Jewish married women, but most married women around the world, probably don't. Although that's actually a bad statement because I don't know about overpopulated areas in other parts of the world. I'm not about to do a survey, but the point is it no longer carries the same meaning that it once did. Right? And that's going to create a bit of a tension. The other difference in terms of tension is, you know, what are the ramifications about, you know, how it pertains to a marriage? The punishment, or if you want to call it a punishment, the ramifications for a woman not covering her head technically is she goes out and loses the ketubah. But that's not the only case where the woman goes out and loses the ketubah. Shalamet take ketubot 110b.
Our rabbis taught, if the husband desires to go up, move to the land of Israel, and his wife refuses, she must be pressed up to go up. And if she does not consent, she may be divorced without a ketubah. If she desires to go up and be refused...
He refuses. Oh, wow. Refuses. That's their typo, not mine.
He must be pressed to go up. And if he does not consent, he must divorce her and pay her zuba. If she desires to leave the land of Israel and he refuses to leave, she must be pressed not to leave. And if pressure is of no avail, she may be divorced without a zuba. If he desires to leave and she refuses, he must be pressed not to leave. And if coercion is of to no avail, he must divorce her and pair zuba.
So this is one you don't hear quoted as often. I mean, people talk about the importance of women's head covering, but the effect is pretty much the same as making aliyah, where if the husband wants to make aliyah and she doesn't, that's grounds for divorce, and she loses the ksuba. If a couple is living in Israel and the woman wants to go outside of Israel, let's say the woman wants to go back to America, husband doesn't want to leave Israel, that's grounds for divorce, and she doesn't get the ksuba. Mm. Right? Same halacha as woman who goes out without the ketubah. Kind of based on this, the way I'm blanking on the person who from whom I got this initially. It's kind of based on something that Rav Meisas, was, I believe, the chief rabbi of Haifa, said, that it depends on hakpadat ba'al. It depends on if the husband is insistent. Meaning, grounds for divorce isn't the same as a requirement to divorce. And if you're going to take, you know, the severity seriously, it's no different than making aliyah, which, you know, seems, according to the Gemara, the mission at least off of this is based, certainly a commandment, and, you know, it's a whole separate shiur about obligation to live in Israel. To my mind, there's absolutely no doubt that there is one. But it's a lot easier, you know, to put on a hat when you go out than it is to move to Israel. That I will concede, yeah. Right? But it's taken on a very different symbol and a very different meaning, even though they're analogous for this very reason. So that's something to keep in mind as well. Another next section, really have to stress a particular point here. And, you know, we sort of touched on this in terms of how hair is covered. And one of the biggest problems in the discussions of women's hair covering, we're going to shift gears into the how should one's hair be covered. And you're going to hear lots of different opinions. How much can be exposed? Can any be exposed and whatnot? And we'll see some later authorities on that too. But it's important to make a distinction between head covering and hair covering. It's not a distinction that I initially made. We'll see in a bit where Moshe Feinstein said so. But we have to look at the source that is often inappropriately brought into this context, and I will explain why. We actually saw this last week when we discussed music, because this is the source that deals with Kol Isha, hearing a woman sing. Please, this is Gemara Brachot 24a.
Isaac said, a handbreadth exposed in a married woman constitutes sexual incitement. In which way? Shall I say if one gazes at it? But has not Rabbi Shesheth already said, why did Scripture enumerate the ornaments worn outside the clothes with those worn inside? To tell you that if one gazes at the little finger of a woman, it is as if he gazed at her secret place. No, it means in one's own wife and when he recites the Shema.
So just stop here. We focused a little bit more on this last week. There are going to be a bunch of statements here about what is considered erva, nakedness or licentiousness, and the specific context that the Gemara is discussing is when the husband wants to say Kriyat Shema at night, usually lying next to his wife, how covered does she need to be in order for him to be able to recite the Kriyat Shema? So now it goes through a bunch of things that are considered erva, things that he is not allowed to see while he is reciting the Kriyat Shema to fulfill his obligation. Continue.
Rabbi Hista said, a woman's leg is a sexual incitement, as it says. Uncover the leg, pass through the rivers, and it says afterwards, thy nakedness shall be uncovered, yea, thy shame shall be seen. Samuel said, a woman's voice is a sexual incitement, as it says, for sweet is thy voice, and thy countenance is comely. Rabbi Shesheth said, a woman's hair is a sexual incitement. As it says, thy hair is as a flock of goats.
Right. Now, as like I said last week, I don't get the goat line. but the point is, people have made the argument that because it says se'er be'isha erva, woman's hair is considered nakedness, therefore every last bit of a married woman's hair must be covered. That's not what the Gemara says, though. One, it's in the context of Kriyat Shema, specifically. Two, there is no distinction in this Gemara explicitly about a married woman. And you'll have some discussions a bit later on, but, you know, if anyone is going to, like, treat these parallel, then just as culturally, many places don't allow women to sing because it's erva, by this logic, we should require all 12-year-old girls to cover their hair, regardless of whether or not they're married, because there's no distinction in the Gemara here. So it's one of those things where these are all listed together. You know, you got to play by the same rules, right? So it's important to make that distinction that the Gemara here of Se'er B'Isha Erva does not really come into play regarding women's head covering. There's a difference between Kisui Rosh, covering the head, and covering the hair. And we'll see in a bit Rav Moshe Feinstein makes that distinction, but it's important to have this separately, just to show in context that the two Gemaras do not go together and should not go together because you are confusing two different laws. All right? So now we'll get into some of the parameters. And a little bit more, because it's running late, I'll take over here. First is a Mishnah in Shabbat. And this has been a source of debate that I had with my father over this. Mishnah in Shabbat 6:5 says, a woman may go out with ribbons made of hair, whether they have her own hair of her companions or an animal, and with frontlets with sarbitin that are fastened to her. She may go out with a hairnet kabul and with a wig, but specifically into a courtyard. The Gemara in Shabbat says, 64b, Rav said, whatever the sages forbade to carry out in public domain on Shabbat is also forbidden to be brought out in a private courtyard, except for a hairnet and a wig. According to letter of Jewish law, assuming, let's say, there's no Eruv, or you don't hold by an Eruv, a woman would not be allowed to go out to a public area wearing a wig. Because it's considered a tachshit for the Baal. It's considered an adornment or jewelry specifically for the husband. Now, this is the debate that I got with my father was, does this still count as kisui rosh, as covering the head? And this was the source of a huge, huge debate back in the day. If you're going to confuse the issues of hair versus head, you see instinctively like how that's a problem. Like, let's say if a woman shaves her head and then makes a wig out of her own hair, right? You can say, well, you're just effectively defeating the purpose, right? But again, we're splitting up those two things. What do I think is going to be more relevant? Well, remember that first Gemara. Let's say you assume that women covering their head is biblical. The how can be rabbinic and subject to change. Which means, at one point, maybe a wig might not have been acceptable, but over time, a wig could have been acceptable. Now, how such change happens, who knows, right? But that comes, if you assume the premise is not embarrassing your husband in public, I argued to my father, well, you know, her head is covered. Like, there's still something on there. And truth is, I can usually tell if a woman's wearing a wig. I've learned over time not to point it out to women because they don't like it. I did that once on a dare, actually, where, you know, I was able to, and even like on a dare when I was being tested, the woman got annoyed by it. Like, yeah, I'm still not smart enough to even, you know, not take the bait. So my father believes that a wig doesn't count at all, kind of based on this Gemara. I would, you know, my initial take was, just because you might be carrying doesn't mean there isn't something on your head. Whether or not that counts as the dot Yehudit could be subjective and might depend on where you are. But it's important to throw that in there. And there's a huge amount of literature covered over wigs itself. Here's the Igrit Moshe that I mentioned earlier. This was written on April 12, 1961. It's Evan Ezra 158. And he writes as follows. Behold, the essence of the prohibition, which is stated in B'Ketuvot 72, the school of Rabbi Shmuel taught that it is a warning for the daughters of Israel not to go out with an uncovered head, and it does not say that it is a warning for women to go out with their hair uncovered, This implies that the prohibition depends on the head being covered, because the covering of only a few hairs isn't considered a covered head. For if the Talmud had said the prohibition was on hair, then it ought to have said that they were judging every strand of hair by itself. However, since it says said head, this refers to the head in general. Right? Pretty straightforward. Where if the Gemara's meant, if the intention was that a married woman's hair needed to be covered, not head, simply put, the Gemara would have said hair and not head. I know, remarkable, like, analysis, but it's sad that this actually needs to be said, because that's how the discussion kind of devolved over the generations, largely due to the confusion of the Gemara in Brachot from 24 on hair being considered erva, with the married woman's requirement to cover their head. Once you start confusing those sources, bam, you wind up saying, like, every single inch needs to be covered, even though, you know, that's clearly not what was mentioned at all. I mean, I don't know any basket that covers, you know, an entire, you know, every strand of hair. And yet that seemed to meet the biblical requirements, but not the dot yehudit, which is certainly, you know, would be more subjective. And a last interesting question that comes up, but not many people think about it, is what do you do at a wedding? Here's the thing. At a wedding, by definition, a woman gets married. Duh. But if a married woman is supposed to cover her head, then what does she do at her own wedding? Huh? When should she start covering her head? So this question was dealt with by Rav Avadya Yosef, Yechavidat, Volume 5, Teshuvah 62. Asks the question, is a bride obligated to cover her head after the Sheva Brachot under the Chuppah when she is immediately considered, quote, married? Here's his answer, at least the summary that he does at the end. Sometimes for certain responses, Yechavidat was his radio show, so it's one of the more readable responses that you're going to find. And every now and again, he has a really convenient summary at the end. So this is his summary that he has at the end. The bride is not obligated to cover her head immediately after the Sheva Brachot under the Chuppah, because the law is she's still considered, quote, engaged, or ki'arusa, in his words, until after seclusion, what we call yichud. And according to what the Ashkenazim practice, that the bride and groom seclude themselves immediately after the Sheva Brachot under the Chuppah, right? If you've ever been to a Jewish wedding, you have the Chuppah, you break the glass, you know, you dance them down to the Yichud room, right? That the intent is that is what you call the Chuppah. In Jewish law, you've got the wedding, how to put this, the wedding ceremony is really divided into two things. There's Kiddushin, which is also counts as called Erusin, I should say, which is when the husband gives the wife the ring, says Hareat Mekudeshet Li Pata Ba'atzo. The Nisuin, the marriage part, is what you call Chuppah, really when the husband takes the wife in to his house. It's mimicked in Ashkenazi practice by the Yichud room, where the husband takes the wife, or whatever you want to call it at that point, into the room that's considered his, and they have Yichud at that point. Right? But according to that Ashkenazi practice, then the bride is obligated to cover her head immediately after leaving the room of seclusion. But the Sephardim and those of Middle Eastern descent do not have the custom of seclusion till after the meal when they go home, and this custom is sacred and do not deviate. So there are some cultures, you know, as you call it, Sephardim and Edot Mizrach, that at the wedding do not have a yichud room. Completely fine. When do they have yichud and do the nisuin? That's when they go home after the wedding. Right? All well and good. But until that point, they don't have to cover their head. According to Rav Avadya Yosef, though, if you're an Ashkenazi person, at your wedding, when does the obligation to cover your head start? Bam! As soon as you come out of that yichud room, then you got to start going into it. There were a few other issues you needed to mention that couldn't really... there was another section of Rav Moshe that... didn't translate, ran out of time, that dealt a little bit more with the location of what does it really mean to go out. Because there is a discussion over, let's say, woman's married. And, you know, I heard once, you know, a woman complained to me about married women friends of hers who didn't cover their head in the home, right? Even when other people were over. Technically speaking, according to, you know, the Mishnah Gemara, the problem is yotza'ah, she has to go out. There's a distinction between private and semi-private, or I should say public and semi-public. Implication being that in private, no such obligation exists. People can spin it in different ways, but to say that a married woman is obligated to have her hair head covered at home doesn't seem to, you know, really apply, because it's when you specifically go out. All right? So what do we see? Saw the primary sources. We saw, you know, initially it's considered dot Yehudit. The Gemara in Ketubot seems to attribute biblical significance to it. That's how it's codified in the Rif Rambam in Shulchan Aruch. Though by pure strict biblical law, it doesn't seem to be that apparent. Meaning the reasoning behind it is by implication. Nothing explicit about women, you know, married women covering the head. We saw there in terms of the nature of the distinctions, what is dot Moshe would be obligatory, whereas dot Yehudit might be subject to change. The severity is the same as other things that we happen not to care about, like making aliyah. It's not comparable to hair in the sense of hair being erva. They're completely different laws, and it's important to separate the two. Question about whether or not wigs apply, because whether or not there's head, those are considered head covering or hair, didn't even touch any of that literature. And assuming you would say that, you know, it would be obligatory from the biblical sense, according to at least Rav Avadia Yosef, it would kick in at the actual time of after the Yichud Rum, which I know very few people who do. I'm trying to remember. I think there was like one example I know of where a woman would like take the veil and like wear it as beret headband thing and throw it over the back. Count as sort of the head covering. Like, oh, your head is now covered. Right. Any thoughts, questions, comments?
I do have a question about, if a woman is in her own house, but she still has to keep it covered if men come over, right?
Where do you see that? Why?
Well, because if it's not her husband, you know, only if it's doesn't say anything, there's no.
Like I said, it's yotza'ah. She goes out.
Okay, so even if there's.
Now, as a matter of practical advice, if there are women and couples listening to this, it makes sense to like discuss this with your respective spouses because, you know, they're the ones that have to, you know, deal with all of this. But yeah, if you want to tell me that a married, like if you have Shabbat guests over, right, to say that a woman has an obligation to keep her head covered in her own house, you have to justify that.
Because there's no
whenever, here's the rule, right? The general rule which applies to anyone. If you want to say something, if you want to impose any law, be it biblical or rabbinic, on someone, either a positive commandment, meaning you have to do something, or a prohibition, saying you're not allowed to do something, the burden is on the person who's telling it to you to cite chapter and verse to say, here's the biblical law you're violating, here's the rabbinic law you're violating. And if they can't do that explicitly, then there's no reason to believe them.
Right, okay.
Right? So if in order, like, all I have here is yotza'ah. She goes out and does these things. Mm-hmm. Right? But in private, we don't require to cover her hair or head all the time. Right? That's a very crucial, crucial distinction.
Right.
Now, it isn't wrong if a woman covers her head in private. But there's a difference saying you're allowed to do something and you have to do something. Mm-hmm. Big difference there.
Another question is, what constitutes like head covering? Some people I see in shul, they just wear like a scarf that covers their head. Is that considered good?
So according to it seems at least according to Rav Moshe, I mean that's the real operative question from the Gemara in Ketuvot that Rav Moshe kind of deals with, and it's pretty much whatever you would say. You've got something on your head, like is your head covered? Now, why baskets wouldn't cut it, but other things would, you can say would be an issue of cultural norms. Why? And this, I think, makes perfect sense, because a woman with a basket on her head may or may not be married. There's no significance behind it. Today, There pretty much is, or at least for, although maybe not as much as it might be back in the day, unless like a woman is actually has, you know, a sign on her hat that says, I am married, you don't really know what the significance is behind the hat. I know in England, like, you know, some of them were coming back in style, and there was a great BuzzFeed list about like the most phenomenal church hats that they have pictures of women wearing. Some of them are crazy elaborate, especially like these Easter, you know, type hats. Some of them are awesome. Anyway, but none of them indicate that you're married. Wearing a basket, you know, though, is something that's a lot more practical, right? It's not a matter of clothing. It's a matter of how you're transporting something.
Right.
So today, what would it mean that you've got something on your head? The truth is, or at least enough to say that your head is covered, pretty much almost anything, right? Baseball cap. Baseball cap could mean almost anything. Your head is covered. You got something on your head, right? You know, Panama hat, you know, that could count.
The point,
you have a larger range than you think of, mm-hmm. because as Rav Moshe, or at least as Rav Moshe, I think, accurately put it, the concern isn't over strands of hair. It's on making sure your head is covered, right? So trying to worry about measurements is, I think, missing the point about like, oh, here's how much is there versus here's how much can be exposed. It would be enough that someone, let's say random person, could say, yeah, you've got something on your head. Or enough, if not something on your head, but someone to say that your head is covered, meaning just a plain old headband, right? Yes, you technically have something on your head. Does that mean your head is covered? Probably not, because a headband, you know, maybe you've got a really flat, small head. You know, it'll cover the surface. Most women don't. You'd probably be dead. But, like, most hats, you know, or things that you put on, or it's like, yeah, your head's covered. You got something on there. That's
right.
It.
Hmm. Because some people say, oh, yeah, hair has to be completely
People
covered.
Say lots of things. That's why I
but
give these the, classes.
That's their...
So you may be able to argue that in certain communities...
Yeah. Customs.
Now that would be an interesting argument. Meaning, if you live in a place where all women cover their hair in a certain way,
yeah, right.
Then you may be able to say, well, this is now dot Yehudit for this area.
Right.
Able to argue that. I mean, it's a plausible argument. Assuming, again, you know, that you don't want to embarrass the husband in public, it might work. The question then is, what is the range of dot Yehudit? And it's a valid question. Because do you do it by your immediate community? Is it by all Jewish women? And is it all Jewish women worldwide? Is it based on your specific locale? Like, how do you determine your sphere of what's considered dot Yehudit, especially today when our communities are so intertwined? Right? Let's say, I mean, because if I'm, let's say, in a walled city, like, you know, modern day ghetto, where all women cover their heads with, you know, headbands, then sure, you may be able to plausibly argue for this community dot Yehudit is in a particular way or in a particular style. Maybe. It's an interesting argument. I can't say that definitively, but you've got a case there. You would just have to then define the basis for defining dot Yehudit as something that's very localized, and then further define the borders of when is it acceptable to deviate and when is it not acceptable to deviate.
Right.
Because before you know it, you're going to have, like, you know, some wearing red headbands, some wearing blue headbands, and you got, like, the Bloods and the Crips going after each other.
But let's say you live in a community where it's, like, 80 or 90% of them are doing a certain, following certain customs, isn't it? Like, you should...
Ah, well, that's the question that... That's a class we gave on custom. And now you're asking a great general question on, you know, popular practice and the process of Pesach, as I called it, so... I'll refer you to that class because that's another hour lecture.
Okay.
It's a wonderful question. That's not a blow-off answer as much as you're asking like the higher level question about the process, mm-hmm. as opposed to the specific thing of like, and when you know the general rules of the process, then you can apply it, you know, things like this of like, well, when lots of people do it this way and in terms of deviations and whatnot, whole separate question there. Right? But at the very least, you have to know the distinction between what's the law part and what's the custom part. And then you can check out the class on custom and some other stuff that we've been dealing with in the Sunday classes. Though not for a while. We've gotten sidetracked with a whole lot of things. All right?
Okay.
Fantastic. Have a wonderful week.